From KMUW Wichita.
From Toronto, Ontario.
And from Armenia, Spain.
This is You're Saying It Wrong. Let's talk words. Let's talk about everything under the sun. It's Mailbag Day. I'm Fletcher Powell, host and producer at KMUW in Wichita, Kansas. And joining me, as they do, of course, each week, language experts and New York Times best-selling authors Kathy Petras and Ross Petras. Before we get started, welcome to listeners to KSLU in Hammond, Louisiana. Although you may be outside of Hammond, I don't know how far KSLU goes outside of Hammond. But we're really happy to have you with us. KSLU picked us up just recently. And so welcome to you and another welcome to all of our listeners. We've been getting lots of listener emails lately, which we love. Please keep sending them in. And so we figured we'd get through a few of those today with a good old-fashioned mailbag day.
We're going to start with email. This one I like because, Ross, I think you and I talked about it. It reminds me of Uncle Jim. Remember
yes,
Uncle Jim
definitely.
Used to talk? Okay. This is an email from a New Yorker, Lou in Queens, who says, I'm a New Yorker. My family's been in New York since the 1920s, and the older ones have that New York pronunciation that you used to hear a lot, which is what Ross and I just talked about with Uncle Jim. The extra R. They'll say idear or soder. He said, where does this come from? Is it just an old New York thing? I'm curious.
I hear that sometimes when I'm hearing some British people talk, too.
Very, very good segue, Fletcher. Exactly. This is really more complex than it seems at first. First of all, we can divide English in many different ways. And one way is saying some English dialects or some English ways of pronunciation are called rhotic and some are called non-rhotic. Rhotic, the rho comes from the Greek, R, the Greek. And rhotic are when people pronounce R's a lot. Like hello, I am Ross, whatever. You use the R. Non-rhotic are when you don't, like the Brits, when they say, rather, the ending R they don't really pronounce. My mother was actually from the South, and she was a non-rhotic Southerner. She would say, we had a vet, and the vet for our dog was Dr. Harper.
Hopper,
I'm sorry. No, it was Dr. Hoppa. At Hopcotch, I'm getting confused.
No, his name was not Harper. It was Hopper.
Dr. Hopper.
H-O-P-P-E-R.
Right, and
yes.
Our uncle came, and my mother was away, and she said, take the dog to go see Dr. Hopper. And my uncle, knowing that she was, basically instinctively knowing that she was a non-rhotic, thought it was Dr. Harper, and that he was looking all over the place for a Dr. Harper, and there was no Dr. Harper.
Oh, that's confusing.
Yes.
Nor was there a Dr. Hoppa.
No, either. I'm confused already. Hopper. Anyway, when people have this accent, they often, when they don't use the R, they often throw in the R. It's called an intrusive R, where it doesn't technically seem to belong.
Yeah. So idear, I-D-E-A-R, in parentheses.
Yeah, or sofer. Idear, sofer. But then you have the opposite, because remember Uncle Jim, you got like, I got an idea, but instead of saying drawer, you say draw.
Draw. And here we go again with the complexity, though, but usually that R is tacked on, like we were saying earlier, basically onto the sofa. It becomes sofer.
At the end of a vowel.
And
yes,
it's usually
exactly. It's usually, right. It's usually precisely.
And it's usually linking to another word.
Oh,
which is weird
okay.
Too.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I've got to interject because with the vowel thing, because a lot of times if the next word starts with a vowel, you'll
yes.
do the R. If the next word does not start with a vowel, starts with a consonant, you'll use the vowel. It'll be sofa, but sofer.
Yeah.
My sofa needs upholstery. My sofer is like looking crappy.
Yeah.
It's like tying it into the next letter, the next word if it needs it.
Right. But now here we go again. Sometimes the R goes inside.
Yeah.
Like Kathy, I have a question to ask both of you. Kathy, we grew up near a town called Hawthorne.
Oh, this fascinates me. It's Hawthorne.
Yes. Fletcher, can you say that town?
You said Hawthorne?
It's interesting.
Do some people say Hawthorne?
Hawthorne.
Yes.
This shows that you are from Bergen County, well, even though Hawthorne isn't a Bergen County, but basically from that region, we basically pronounce, it was funny because I was talking to a friend of mine from, he lives there right now. He was from Ridgewood where we used to live, but he moved to Hawthorne. And he says Hawthorne. And my wife heard that. She goes, what is that? But in that area, I think it's the only intrusive R I ever heard Wes use. Huh. Everyone else doesn't. We don't, we're basically non-intrusive R speakers, but Hawthorne is a lot of times Hawthorne. And you can tell a native speaker by that, which is interesting.
That one makes a little bit of sense just because that other R is in there, the thorn, Hawthorne. It does seem a little easier to say Hawthorne. I can get Hawthorne. That one. What I don't completely get, and my mother does this, is, for example, Kathy, you used to live in Washington.
Yeah, okay. This is what Randy's mom does that. She's from originally from California, like rural California. Oh. And she's Washington. I've got to do the wash, all of that. And it fascinates me because it's so, to my ears, so odd.
Is there regional specificity with the wash?
Well, Fletcher, you just asked a question that the American Dictionary, the Dictionary of American Regional English, will exactly answer. They describe the dialectical warsh or warsh pronunciation as widespread, I'm going to quote them, widespread in the U.S., but especially frequent in the Midland, a belt that extends roughly from New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Virginia, North Carolina, all across the country to Arkansas, Missouri, Iowa, and Nebraska.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes a bit of sense. So, like I said, my mom says Warsh. She was born in Nebraska and lived there for a little bit. I know another person who says Warsh who lived in southeast Kansas, which would be quite close to, say, Missouri or getting on toward Arkansas. And I don't hear that from everybody in Kansas.
Well, it's interesting, I was going to say, because Randy's mom, my mother-in-law, was, as I said, grew up in California. But her family came, where there were Germans from Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh.
So I'm assuming that it was brought, like her mom and dad got it from the Pennsylvania warsh. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you just hear your mom saying it, and I guess you pick it up.
It is interesting, though. It seems to be declining. Linguists are saying that actual usage is declining right now. Mm-hmm. People are now more saying wash, not warsh.
Well, although, don't you think, though, I'm sorry, Russell, just for a second, I was the same thing when Lou said his parents or his elders use the idea,
right,
but not younger people. Isn't that, don't you think that's just part of the blurring with TV and internet and stuff where we just, we're homogenized?
I was about to say exactly that. And it, when you said that, it just reminded me, when we were kids, we'd go down to visit our southern relatives, my mom being from Georgia, and I remember then they seemed to be really different. Remember that, Cap? Mm-hmm. Mary and Kelly were really different. They talked funny.
Well, I remember writing letters to my friends back home and saying their jeans were so short.
I know.
Like, oh my God.
Whereas now we went down now and you remember that kind of, they all seem like,
I remember it vividly.
It's completely homogenized to that, or not completely, but it's very much homogenized, and the accent seems to be, to some degree, fading even in that sense as well, or certain of the usages are definitely fading. But I think also warsh and wash, I think what Fletcher said earlier, getting your mouth around that, I think a lot of times when it's a vowel and the SH, getting your mouth around that warsh makes a lot of sense.
I don't think so. I think wash is easier than warsh.
Wash, warsh. I can see it.
Wash. I think wash is a lot easier.
Warsh. No, I can see it both ways, but I can see how that mouth gets around it, and that's what seems to happen.
Yeah, I can see it. Washington.
Washington. Yeah.
Yeah, I can see it easily. Yeah. I mean, maybe because I grew up hearing it, but
it's interesting though. Yet again, it looks as though it came from the Scotch-Irish, which it always fascinates me. It's a big Scrabble player. How many words come from the Scots? Mm-hmm. I mean, really, it's uncanny.
I think in terms of the States, it's not surprising because they a lot of them emigrated here. So we're using what their dialect is. Whereas in England, there are a lot of people who were not from Scots or Irish areas. So they kept a different way of speaking. Anyway, it's as easy as pie to discuss this. Boy, what a horrible segue.
But Russ. I'm ashamed to be your sister.
I have too. But we got an email from Emily from Kansas about easy as pie. My mind has been spiraling deeper after idiom discussion, as easy as is widespread, but its different endings vary greatly, especially in their literal meanings. Some mention activities that are actually easy. such as falling off a log or taking candy from a baby.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, we got interested in the whole concept of as easy as.
It's funny because I didn't think, but it's true, the baby. Do people still say those? That's what's getting me with idioms in general. It's like, are you guys hearing, like, I don't really think I hear as easy as taking candy from a baby or falling off a log like you used to, are you?
No, but I mean, I don't know how much you used to either. I don't know. Is that something that people said all the time? I mean, I know it's commonly known, like everybody knows those phrases, but like how often were they actually used? I don't know.
That's a good question, because in both cases, actually, Contra Kathy, like, I instantly know falling off a log or taking candy from a baby. I don't even have to think about it. So that means it must be used to some degree, because I wasn't like, now what is, I mean, you know, I can see it, I know it, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Well, that's the whole point of an idiom, isn't it? I mean, to make things nice and snappy.
But that would also basically think, therefore, that it's still in some usage enough to basically not have to think about it.
Okay, but I think that was just sort of the first half of the email, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I just wanted to say, though, quickly, because Ross and I got fascinated with the as easy as, and we found there's every language and every culture has, there's as easy as bread and butter, as easy as bread and cheese. I like that. That's Albanian. There was easy as a cat's cough. That was Croatian. Easy as a slap in the face. Okay. That was Czech. But at fast, I could do that with two fingers in my nose. That was Dutch. I just loved all of these. But yeah, back to Emily. She was specifically asking about easy as pie.
Mm-hmm.
And she was saying, is it because making pie is easy? Or is it sarcastic? Is it like, yeah, easy as pie?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why I sounded like that saying.
Well, sarcastic.
That
was, you were
pretty evocative, Kat, I have to say.
Whenever I hear it, it is just straight ahead. I mean, that means something super easy as pie.
Mm-hmm.
But why? Wait, when you hear something's easy as pie, I mean, that doesn't sound like a sarcastic thing to me.
No, but that's what, but why pie?
Yeah.
Why is pie easy?
Yeah. Why is pie easy? Because I think, as Emily pointed out, making a pie is not necessarily the easiest thing to do.
It's not easy at all. No,
we want to say Duff also. We have to get another person who wrote in about easy as pie. Duff also said, it seems strange because baking isn't all that easy.
Uh-huh.
But then he said, I recently saw an article that explained it referred to the ease of eating a pie, not baking it. Am I surprised? Does the Pope not eat a pie in the woods?
That would make sense. Eating a pie is quite easy, for me, at least.
And there are some people who say it really was like eating a pie, the idiom at first, or revolving around eating.
Mm.
And then by the late 1800s, they were saying it came in the 1800s, but the later 1800s, the eating part was dropped, and it morphed into as easy as pie.
Well, sort of like the proof of the pudding. The proof is in the pudding, right? Mm-hmm. The proof of the pudding is in the eating. Isn't that what it's supposed to be?
Yeah.
Why do we keep dropping the eating part? That seems like the most important part to me.
Well, that's the whole thing. They said, I think it's because there were so many other sayings as easy as, don't you think? So there was some that said it came from nice as pie. People said as nice as pie, meaning like that was somebody good. So
but then
it was just
easy doesn't really fit that idiom, though.
Well, that's why I thought that was a stupid thing. Not stupid, I'm sorry. I shouldn't say that so much. I get too angry about this.
I think what happens is just we use shorthand. I think as easy as eating pie is kind of blah, 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 like that. So you just cut that part out and just have easy as pie. And then you begin to lose the initial meaning of the whole thing, I think is what happens.
Then why not just say like pie? It's just like pie, no?
Catherine, just hang around another 200 years and we'll find out.
I'm working on it, Ross. Don't trust me. I have things I'm doing.
Okay, we have a new email here. This was interesting. This comes from Doug. Once for quite a while, the most abused word used to be epic. That song's epic.
Mm-hmm.
That put down was epic. Everything one liked was epic, and if everything was epic, that meant nothing was epic.
I actually love this email.
I know.
I've got to thank you, Doug. This was such fun to read. Go on, Ross.
Beowulf is epic. The Iliad and the Odyssey are both epic. Moby Dick is epic. Ben-Hur is epic. The Epic of Gilgamesh is, by definition, epic. And then this brilliant line at the end. That French toast you had at brunch with whipped cream, maple syrup, and mixed berries was not epic. But I don't hear epic so much now. Now it's iconic. People throw iconic around without any idea what it means. It used to mean, seems to mean all things to all people like they're Humpty Dumpty. When I use a word, it means just what I choose it to mean, neither more nor less. Bloody anarchists. It's almost as if iconic doesn't even have a definition. It just sounds smart. Smart enough to overuse. I don't want to keep hearing it, but I can't escape it. So, let's discuss epic and iconic.
I gotta say, I am so with Doug. That was an epic email.
You know what got me? It was almost like as if it was planned. I was at a little party and we were eating dinner and two early 40s, a couple, both were talking about something and they both said, that was just so epic.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, wow. Oh, wow. I was, wow, you both said it too.
It definitely, I'm with you, Russell, because so many people I know that are in their 40s, that group is big still on epic. I think.
Yep.
Yeah.
And this was another, there was another young daughter here. I looked quickly because we talked about earlier with another eye rolling episode. I looked quickly to see if eyes rolled, but I didn't see the daughter saying anything. So whatever. But because they don't say epic, younger people.
I don't know anybody who says epic anymore, really.
Did you say it, Fletcher?
I don't know if I said it. That doesn't seem like me, so probably not. Iconic? I think iconic might be going out a bit too, although I understand what Doug was saying. And if he's going to write emails like that, then we can just read Doug's emails every every episode.
Yeah, I don't think I hear epic as much. I mean, I as I said, I see it like on social media still. I'm thinking, do I see iconic as much as epic still? What do you think?
I've seen iconic fairly frequently. I'm just looking it up right now. Okay, here we go. I found one from Newsweek this year. Tanya Van Houten, I don't know how you pronounce her name, a fashion designer from California, got together with her siblings to recreate an iconic childhood photo shoot.
That is sort of how I tend to hear it, although that childhood photo shoot, iconic, I usually hear it though in like something more like everybody would know it, not your own childhood photo shoot.
Let's try Variety Magazine. 2025 to 28th of January. The cinema posted a petition on its social media accounts calling for help saving the iconic theater, which had been praised
See,
by the likes of
Quentin Tarantino. See, but that's different than epic. That to me is very different.
Yes. That has
than
a,
epic.
That has a sort of valuable, I mean, a valid, I think, usage.
That
there.
Is how I usually hear it is the way
Me too.
Is the way it was in that particular sentence. Yeah. It's a thing that
when it's something
it's
that is indeed iconic.
That people recognize, like the general public would recognize this thing. Maybe it does not reach the level of what iconic ought to be, but it's at least something that is publicly known that you would you
see.
Would
I agree with you. That's what I've seen. I have not seen as Doug said, I do not see iconic being, I see it being used a lot when I don't think it is really iconic,
right.
But I don't think I see it being used like epic where I would like hold up, I don't know, my phone and say, just got the new Pixel. It's epic. I don't think I would hold it up and say it's iconic. You know what I mean? I don't think it is epic anyway.
How about this one? The Kylie Cosmetics founder, 27, stepped out at Chanel's Autumn Winter 2025 show. Wearing an iconic silhouette from the fashion house with a twist.
Well, fashion here. Chanel, I know what an iconic Chanel outfit would be.
Okay.
That's legit.
Now, the discussion basically is saying, he actually put up, we didn't show it, but he put up an icon, you know, a Greek or Orthodox icon.
Right.
Mm-hmm. As saying, but I think the meaning has changed somewhat. And to be really fair to people using it, as we just talked about, it does come from the ancient Greek word icon, which meant a likeness or an image or a portrait with a broad meaning. Then, language always changes. Then in later times, it basically came to mean a religious image, you know, an icon. Mm-hmm. And now it's kind of broadened again. It kind of went bloop, bloop, and it got, you know, got bigger again. So that's called the bloop, bloop language.
Yeah, a linguistic term right there. Proper linguistic term. So I don't think Doug is necessarily wrong so much as we haven't exactly seen it used the way he's describing it.
In fairness to him, I'm looking at his email again. He says you don't hear epic as much. People are throwing iconic around without any idea of what it means.
Okay.
It just sounds smart. I'll give him that. I don't think it's used in the same exact way as epic. But in fairness to him, he did not say that.
Okay.
No, he didn't.
He was just saying you don't hear epic as much, now you hear iconic.
Yeah, right. Okay.
That was a really pretty epic statement, Kathy.
I am epic, Rulis. Back when I used to play World of Warcraft, I had some epic gear, I might say.
I think you guys are right on that one, though. But I don't like either word really overused at this point either, though. I mean, iconic, I think, is really overused nowadays, too, to some degree. I think
the problem is, as we've talked about this before, is the excessive hyperbole nowadays.
Yeah.
Everything's like, you know, boom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's not.
No.
Sometimes it's just nice or good, you know?
Yeah. And that's just fine.
So how do you do? I can't even come up with a segue. So how you doing, Fletcher? How you doing, Ross?
yeah, good, Kathy. what's going on?
Well, Paul had emailed us a while back and was talking about the phrase, how do you do?
Uh-huh.
And he said, if you watch TV and movies from the 70s and earlier, you'll invariably hear a person say, how do you do, when introduced to someone. And he said, I can't remember the last time I've heard anyone say this in conversation, but it was said all the time on any TV show or movie you watch. When and why did this custom fade out?
This is really interesting because Kath and I were talking about this a little bit earlier. And oddly enough, we have all these like etymological discussions of how do you do. But the interesting thing was, how often was it used even in the past? I was watching, have you ever seen The Bachelor and the Bobby Soxer?
Yeah.
No.
It's a movie from the 1930s or 40s. And in the movie, it's a comedy with Cary Grant. It's really good. It's a really fun film.
It's very fun. Yeah.
But in the end with Rudy Valli. And in the film, Rudy Valli plays a sort of stuffy lawyer. And he says, how do you do?
Mm-hmm.
And other people laugh at him for saying, she goes, well, what a stuffy person. How do you do?
Oh, wow.
So the fact that in a 40s popular comedy, how do you do would be referenced as being stuffy makes me wonder, did anyone ever really say it? Or was it just
I disagree with you. I think they did. I disagree with you. I mean, I can only go by Hollywood, of course, because I was not alive then. But people did. I remember that vaguely, like, you know, like mom and dad's friends or something saying, how do you do?
Do you?
You wouldn't say, how do you do, like that. You would say, how do you do?
I don't remember. Oddly enough, I was trying to think about that. I would think, like, how are you? Or, hi, nice to meet you.
Howdy.
That's what I would think that people would say.
Howdy?
Howdy. Well, I mean, that's what it comes from,
well,
right? Fletcher's how do you do? Howdy?
How do you do?
No, it does, but howdy just sounds sort of odd to me saying howdy,
people don't,
too.
Yeah, I mean, people do say that, but I was just throwing that in because of where it comes from. Ross, I think that's kind of compelling, though. I mean, Kathy doesn't seem quite as persuaded, but if they were making fun of it in a 1940s movie, then it was at least weird to some people even back then.
Fairness though, Ross, I saw the film. They were making fun of how he did it.
I can understand what you're saying, but
he was being more like, how do you do?
But I can see that, but it was, I think you're right on that too. But I do think that there was a little bit of the idea it was a formal thing that he was saying that wasn't really that acceptable. I think you can nuance it either way to use new, I mean, I don't know. But I'm just wondering the fact that they would even mention that would strike me as maybe. And then I started thinking back, and I don't think I ever used how do you do in my life, ever. I think I would say, hi,
how are you, or
hi, nice to meet you.
Well, that's because it was sort of done by the time we became adults. You didn't say how do you do.
But he was saying if you watch films or movies from the 1970s and or earlier, and I don't. You know, I mean, we can argue back and forth because there's no way of knowing. But I'm really curious if it's more of a convention that you do in books or film where it's something written down as a script and you do it, but it was not really said. It was a convention that people think that they should have said or said. That's what I'm. I have no way of knowing it, and I don't think we can argue back and forth. But neither of us really know.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it was used, but I mean, I don't know.
Do we have an answer for when it sort of faded, at least from more popular culture, even if we can't necessarily nail down what people are actually saying?
We can tell him when it started.
That works.
That's what I'm looking at. It began being used in the 1800s. Mm-hmm. How do you do? Mm-hmm. Which surprised me, because I would have thought it was older than that. I mean, you had variations on it earlier. From the 1600s, it was how do you do, how do you fare?
Right.
When did it stop?
Well, it's interesting. I looked on the Google Ngram, which is, of course, extremely unscientific. They have like a brief pop-up in 1825, then a steady downhill trend throughout the 60s, throughout the late 1800s, all the way down, 1940s, down, which is good, 1960s, down. And then they have a pop-up in 2020.
Oh,
really?
Weird.
Yep. So which I think shows basically we're all talking as if we all have no idea about this at all. But I think it's very interesting, the usages.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever said it. Have you?
No, that's why I was saying I'm wondering. I mean, being, you know, with our parents, we're presuming that they would have, according to what film said, we're presuming that they would have used it. And I think I would have like picked up a little bit of it. And I don't remember ever saying it either. And they're saying,
yeah.
And then this linguistic thing said, the phrase, how do you do, has long since gone out of fashion in British English and was never in fashion in American English. Now, I don't know, again, how this person's bona fide. I don't know if that person's correct. But they're saying American English always used hello. I don't think it, I still think that it's like a, I mean, we have
fake.
A quote from, I think Oscar Wilde here, whatever. How do you do, Mr. Darlington? And I think that sort of thing was...
It was sort of like a fake grafting onto.
Yeah, and maybe they did say it in English very formally. I don't know.
I just want to say, I love this, though, from Emily Post's Etiquette in the 20s. Said, best society has only one phrase in acknowledgement of an introduction. How do you do? It literally accepts no other. When Mr. Bachelor says, Mrs. Worldly, may I present Mr. Struthers? Mrs. Worldly says, how do you do? Struthers bows and says nothing. When a reply is in order, however, it should not be charmed.
But that's interesting, too, because the formal, because then it goes on, it should not even be pleased to meet you or the like. It should be...
No, it should be.
Oh, that's right, because it should be a remark that leads to conversation. I would have hated those days with all those formal things you have to do.
I would have done very badly, I suspect. How do you do?
Okay, Fletcher, but we're going to move on now from etiquette.
Thank goodness.
Well, I wouldn't say thank goodness, Fletcher, because we're going to close with a quiz question on grammar, a pop quiz. And should we say it might make you, should we say... tense.
Ha ha! That's a clue.
Kath, why don't you read the email?
Okay, we got an email from Kelly in New Orleans who said she hoped it was a, quote, gotcha moment for Fletcher. I love these people. She asked us to ask you the following. What is the tense in the following sentence?
Oh, no.
Okay, Fletcher, have fun.
Kelly.
Fletcher, Alfred Hitchcock has directed films appealing to both those interested in a crime and those interested in psychology. Okay, what is the tense of the verb here? Simple present. Present perfect.
This is evil, Ross.
Past perfect or present continuous. I'm going to give you the thing again. A, simple present. B, past perfect. Oh, sorry, B, present perfect. I'm kidding. C, past perfect. D, present continuous.
So we're looking at, I assume Alfred Hitchcock has directed.
Has directed is the verb.
Yeah. Kelly in New Orleans, no human being can answer this question.
Simple present, present perfect, past perfect, or present continuous.
I'm going to interject. I want to know, Kelly, could you have answered this question?
okay. Well, I mean, has directed seems like something that happened in the past. So I'm going to say past perfect.
And Fletcher, we're all in the present here, and you're wrong. It's actually not. It's the present perfect. The perfective form of the verb is the directed, and the present form of has. So he completed it, but its relevance extends into the present.
Oh.
It's a connection between the two, Fletcher. We're connecting the past and the present.
I got to say, Kelly, we love you.
I think this is a Hitchcock horror for Fletcher.
I want her to send more now.
I know.
What pain can we inflict upon Fletcher?
I know.
I don't know. Ask him any grammar question and then make him use correct terms.
Actually, Kathy, what we should do is we should every week give Fletcher a verb grammar question. You know, I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, I was going to say, you could probably ask me this exact question next week, and I will still not have the, past something? Oh, no. Present perfect.
Present perfect. It is interesting, though, how you know, that is gone from learning language nowadays.
You don't learn perfect.
No, because that gets me with my Spanish teacher when she says certain things and I panic when she's so like, what tense is this, Kathy?
I'm curious actually with that with Europeans learning languages, because a lot of those Latinate ones are so based on grammar in that sense. I wonder if they teach more grammar in European countries than they do.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you this, and I think it'll make some people angry. Why should we learn it? Who cares?
Two things, I think. To some degree, I mean, you can a language can be made more precise by knowing how grammar works. And I think for learning other languages, it could be really valuable. I mean, to learn.
Really?
Yeah, I think so, actually.
I'm in the middle of you guys. I mean, for me, I have to learn it because I'm learning Spanish. Well, because
I live
here.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
But by the other token, I'm kind of with Fletcher in that, like, I get weary of, I don't know, I yes, it helps you learn another language, but I don't know. I always just did things by, like, life, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. Like, speaking English, I really don't know why I would need to learn what the present perfect is. But if I were speaking another language or trying to learn another language, I could see how it would be helpful to some extent. But
yeah,
also it might fill my head with some junk. Like, I'm trying to figure out, oh, is it present perfect? Is it blah, blah, blah?
Yes.
Maybe I should just go talk to some people.
No, but I don't think you're doing that, though. I mean, I think, you know, I don't think you really need to know this exact term. But I think when I'm trying to learn languages, a lot of times it's good for me to, like, and I think it's basically how you learn things. Some people learn differently than others.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I like to have, like, this is how it works. Mm-hmm. And then I can plug in all the words that I've
learned. I think that's an interesting point, Ross, because I don't have that, as you know.
No, you don't. I know.
It's like I hate reading manuals. I mean, this is why part of my life has been, like, fixing things that I broke mm-hmm. from the very beginning. But also, I just do better in it. I just do mm-hmm. better, like, sort of going into the water, if you will.
I think that's totally legitimate, what you're both
saying. It depends on
right
you
now.
What you are. Because yeah. I had like an inductive Arabic when I was in the Foreign Service. They didn't really teach us grammar. They just taught us, like, this is how you speak. And I was like, you know, I didn't really get it. Then I got a book and I just, like, broke it all down. And then I went to, when I was sent over to Saudi Arabia, I picked it up, like, almost fluently at the time.
Interesting.
And to me, the grammar was the part that did it. But I think other people are inductive, deductive learning. I think it depends
Fletcher,
on how you
so
learn.
You're more like me, you think?
I think it totally depends. I mean, it's nice when I have some structure and I can plug things into mm-hmm. it. With language, yeah, definitely. I mean, certainly with English, I'm pretty good at it, and I don't know any of these terms.
Mm-hmm. I think you're very good at it. So I think that basically you're probably more of an inductive, you know, learner. You learn by, like, hearing yeah. it and doing it.
Yeah, but what you said totally makes sense. I mean, there is definitely something to be said for, you know, learning the structure and learning the rules, even if it's so that you can break them later. You know, it's good to know those things.
Well, that's like the thing with art. Like, that's a pet peeve of mine. Ross, you'll know that. Yeah, with
modern
art.
Yeah, Mom always said that. Yeah.
You have to know how to really draw a body to not draw the body, if you will, you know?
So, Fletcher, we're going to give you next week, we're going to have the entire episode Well, the verb forms for Fletcher.
And also some Latin, Ross.
That's a great idea. Verb forms for Fletcher. Present perfect or present continuous, Fletcher. Quick!
How do you do?
How have you been doing? You're Saying It Wrong is part of the NPR network and is produced in the studios of KMUW in Wichita, Kansas by me, Fletcher Powell. Kathy Petrus records from her home in Armilla, Spain. Ross Petrus from his home in Toronto, Ontario in Canada. Torrin Anderson composed our theme music, and our digital team is Beth Golay, Kate Hutchins, and Carly Cooper. You can find all of our past episodes by subscribing to the You're Saying It Wrong podcast wherever you get your podcasts, or by visiting us at kmuw.org. If you have a question for Kathy and Ross, if you'd like to suggest a topic, or you just want to reach out, you can email me at powell@kmuw.org or email them at kandrpetrus@gmail.com. You can also email us a voice memo of you asking it your question. You might get your voice heard on air. If you'd like to do the same thing by downloading the KMUW app, you can do that and just click the Talk to Us button. You can find all of Kathy and Ross's books pretty much anywhere you get books, and a handful of them are also available on audiobook, read by the authors themselves. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.